Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it. Whether you're pacing short for your START goals or your summer melt needs a cool down, your challenges can be overcome with the right partner. In collaboration with the EdUp Experience, our sponsors, MDT Marketing, are offering a free marketing consultation. Head to www.mdtmarketing.com/edup and start your free consultation. It's direction for your unique situation that will help you ramp up your marketing and enrollment efforts, and it's all for free. Head to www.mdtmarketing.com/edup.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, bringing you the best and brightest and most influential minds in higher education and beyond. My name is Elizabeth Leiba. And joining me today, I have Loki Mulholland. Loki, what's up? I'm so glad that you're here today.
Yes, it's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to this one.
I'm excited. You are a social justice warrior like myself, and we have a great deal to talk about as far as equity and as far as social justice and some of the things that are going on around the country. We definitely have a lot to discuss, and I love to hear your perspective. So without further ado, we're going to bring on our esteemed guest for today. We've been waiting, anticipating speaking with her, and I know it's going to be really interesting. We have Karen Gross, former college president, author, educator, and senior counsel with Finn Partners. Karen, how are you today?
Hi, nice to be with you all.
Thank you so much. We want to jump right into it because you have a ton of insight. A lot of the things that Loki and myself are really passionate about, you have a lot of interest in, and also a lot of experience with a lot of these areas. So why don't you start by telling us just about your background? I'm so fascinated by the idea that you have so much insight into higher education, have served in a leadership role, and now do so much work in terms of the trauma aspects and mental health and social emotional learning. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started and what led you to where you are today?
Sure. And I'll make a long story very short. So I've had what many people would call an episodic career. I've been a professor for 2+ decades, and from there, and by the way, when I was a professor, I focused on asset building in low-income communities. I focused on vulnerable populations. And then I became a college president of a small college where almost 50% of the students were Pell eligible. Mm-hmm. And a number of the students were first-generation students. And that experience of helping students find their best selves and become their best selves and retain and move forward to graduation became a focus of my work. And I started thinking about why do some students succeed against all odds and why don't others succeed? And I then went to the Department of Education, where I served as a senior policy advisor, and did a lot of work on an interagency task force involving the military and the adjustment from military life to civilian life, which is all about transitions, which, by the way, we don't do very well anywhere. Not only don't we do it well in the military, but we don't transition well from grade to grade, from school to college, from college to the workplace. And so it got me thinking about what are the impediments to change? What is making it difficult for people? And so I started writing adult and children's books that focused on what can we think about that would help us improve the outcomes of our students, particularly our most vulnerable students? And while this was going on, I was teaching at a 100% free and reduced lunch school, elementary school in Vermont. I was reading to kids around the globe. I was teaching at the Rutgers Graduate School of Social Work on trauma. They have a trauma program. I'm a psychological first aid provider, so I would go to disaster sites like school shootings or concert shootings or student or young people detention in immigration facilities. And all of that led to writing two adult books that are really cycles. They're next to each other. One describes why some students succeed and some don't. And the other says, well, for the students who don't succeed, what can we do to enable their success? So I focus really on what strategies we need to be thinking about. And much of this work initially was written pre-pandemic, but then in the last year, we've had more traumas than you can even begin to list. So we've had traumas related to the pandemic and family dysfunction and opening and closing of schools and all sorts of issues in that arena. Then we've had natural disasters of a wide ranging sort, from fires to floods to no electricity. Then we've had shootings of in places where we hopefully never have shootings. And then we've had a host of racial and ethnic discrimination and a growing equity gap that has traumatized many. And it is both individuals who are Black and Brown. And that has hurt them and hurt us as a nation. And then we've had the riots at the Capitol, and need I go on, we've had a hard year filled with trauma. So that's what I think about, that's what I do. And my goal, and I have hope, is to help us find pathways forward. Mm.
So what you've been busy.
Yes, yeah, only a few things on your checklist. What are some of the things we need to do better when we think about trauma, when we think about mental health? I think for myself, working in education for so long, it feels as though it's one of the areas that always kind of gets pushed a little bit to the side. We're thinking about academic outcomes. We're thinking about completion. We're thinking about graduation. I think it's only been really since all of these things have happened with the pandemic and with some of the racial issues that we've tried to reimagine or refocus on as a country, that we're starting to look at trauma. What are some of the things that we need to do better? How can we better address some of these issues as far as mental health as a sector? What are some of the things that you're consulting with or ask, what are universities, colleges and universities, or even K-12, what are they asking you as far as, or what are you advising them as far as what are the things that we need to do and how can we address and help our students?
All right, so let's start with this reality. For the most part, our educators are not trauma trained. And our schools of education don't train teachers to identify trauma, let alone how to address it. And one of the hallmarks of trauma is that once you've been traumatized, it doesn't go away. It can be ameliorated for sure, but it doesn't go away and it can keep getting re-triggered. So for many students, we had trauma before the pandemic, but the pandemic reignited, in a sense, earlier trauma that predated the pandemic. And then there was new trauma related to the pandemic. And then, just to make matters worse, trauma is catching. It's kind of like a virus, so educators can catch it from their students, literally. Mm-hmm. And that's secondary trauma and vicarious trauma. So here's what I've tried to talk to schools about. It fits in an architecture that I call name, frame, and tame. So the first thing you have to do is you have to name what's happening. And you have to acknowledge the existence of trauma. Now, many people don't like that word. And whether you like toxic stress better, or you like cortisoaked, or whatever your word is. But you have to name what's happening. So you can, if you don't name it, you can't tame it. And once you've named that, what accounts for student behavior and symptomology of trauma is what's occurring, then you can start to develop strategies to ameliorate it. And those strategies vary dramatically based on context, based on individual life experience, based on the situation. And there's acute trauma and there's deferred trauma. But often we don't see what's happening as trauma symptomology. We see kids acting out. We see kids at all levels being dysregulated or disassociated or disengaged or overregulated. And we like attribute it to something's wrong with them. Like, ooh, like what's wrong with you? What we should be saying is what happened to you? That's a totally different question. And once we figure out what's happened, then you can come up with ameliorating strategies if you've been trained, which is why we should increasingly have trauma responsive schools and trauma responsive pedagogy to help all of our students of every age and stage navigate forward. Now, we should have had it before, but we most assuredly need it now. And then we need to tame it, as in frame it, as in to use the word frame in two contexts. One is put it in a frame and recognize its importance. Trauma and its impact is important. And what we do about it matters. It's not like two kids are traumatized. Pre-pandemic, between 50 and 65% of all kids had experienced one trauma. 70% of all adults had one trauma. Well, that was pre-pandemic data. If you look at it now, I'd say virtually everyone has been traumatized, even if their symptomology differs. So we have to frame it, as in recognize its importance. And then, as in frame, like frame a house, we need a way of holding this up, of creating a structure in which we can think about these issues, address these issues, and focus on these issues. So what I've been doing with institutions is helping them name, tame, and frame what's happening now.
One of the things that kind of comes to mind is how we identify trauma. And so for me, you know, as a common person, as you were saying, we kind of struggle with that word to begin with. How are we going to define this? But as you know, I think of trauma, I think of, you know, like we're saying, you know, just, you know, some big massive event that just took place that's very cataclysmic, if you will. But do we miss the mark by going big on trauma oftentimes and not recognizing some of the smaller things? That how do we want to define that? Okay. How should we define that?
So historically, we used a distinction known as big T and little t trauma. So big T trauma is the stuff you're describing, the cataclysmic event, the plane crash, something like that. The little t trauma was things like family dysfunction, alcoholism, drug addiction, and the like, which is more chronic as opposed to acute. But the reality is they are both trauma. And calling one big and one little suggests that one is more important than the other. So I refer instead in my recent book to getting away from the big T, little t stuff and talking about big E or little e events. These are events that happen to individuals and communities that affect the capacity of the individuals and perhaps families and organizations and entities to progress forward along a pathway towards success.
When you talk about the idea of trauma, and I guess when we think about how we address it, especially in higher education, as far as not leaving it at the door or being cognizant of how trauma can impact every area, especially for students, that the question of how schools might be able to be a place for healing trauma. What are some of the things that we can do as institutions to be more sensitive to that? Like, how can we integrate the idea that students are dealing with financial and food and housing and so many different areas of insecurity, whereas maybe a year ago, we weren't thinking about that? So the wraparound services where we think about mental health on campus and things like that, what are some of the conversations that institutions are having with you, and how are our colleges and universities stepping up to the plate to create that healing place, if that's something that can be done?
Well, I do think schools and universities can be places for healing trauma. And I'd like to tell you that everybody is already stepping up and addressing it. I sadly think that to date, the focus has largely been on physical well-being. And our schools and colleges have focused on everything from how do we do online learning with quality pedagogy to when we return, do we do hybrid learning? Do we situate the desks in a different way? Do we not have faculty hours? Do we not do sports? How do we deal with masks and social distancing and materials, and how does a library work and things like that? I think sadly, we have not paid enough attention to the psychological well-being of either the students or the educators. And I'm defining educators really broadly to include not just professors, but also all the staff people who work within an institution, whether it's in maintenance or food service or any other capacity within an institution, because everyone has been affected in one way or another by an ongoing trauma that has become chronic. And we tend to want to deal with something that's acute. So for example, we'll for at least while it's in the news cycle, focus on a shooting because it's acute. We're less aware of the psychological toll of something that's chronic, like the pandemic, which has just gone on and then on some more. And the other sort of flaw in all of this is that we've turned off and on education as if they were light switches, that you just shut them down and then you just like open them up. And I would say, no. We did shut them down that way, but that's not ideal. And they're most assuredly not like light switches in terms of opening them up. So you have to ask a lot of questions before you reopen. And even if you've reopened now, you should ask new questions about how to reopen in the fall. You should be asking things like, how should we meet and greet students when they arrive back on campus? Not the school that said to me, well, you know, we've got our head of school out there and she's wearing a mask and a screen and she's got a thermometer. And I'm thinking, no, that's not what I mean. If she's an elementary school head of school, dress her up as the mascot, right? Put ears and unicorn things on her and put, you know, fancy things on the thermometer and decorate her mask. And not have her just there by herself, have a whole team of people who welcome you. So I've developed a set of questions, 11 questions that institutions need to ask themselves to plan, prepare, and predict for what the fall will look like. And the problem is we're not asking most of them. We're focusing, and it's not unimportant, by the way, on our physical well-being. But no matter how good our physical well-being is, if our students aren't ready, willing, and engaged and ready to learn, it doesn't matter much what you do in school anyway. If they're not there with you, you can be the best, you know, French poetry professor who teaches Baudelaire on the face of the earth and it won't sink in. Or you can be the best reading teacher, and if the kid hasn't had breakfast, he or she won't be with you. And if a kid has watched their younger siblings and has been parentified over the last year, then they too are not going to be ready, willing, and able to learn, whether that's in high school or college. So here's the overarching question. I don't think we actually ask or think about who are our students.
How are schools positioning themselves to address the particular needs of those students? Because like you said, it seems as though we're so focused on who our ideal student is that we're not looking at the fact that that type of student doesn't really exist anymore. So what are the conversations that you're having with college leadership, and what are some of the initiatives or strategies that have come up in some of those conversations?
Okay, so now is a really hard time to lead. Let's just start there. Educational institutions of higher learning are experiencing financial stressors above and beyond that which they experienced before. And you have to attribute to them goodwill and a genuine interest in helping students succeed. But having said that, I think sadly, not enough institutions are focused optimally on the issues that we're describing here, how to help the students that are enrolling and should be enrolling in colleges today. How are we enabling them to succeed? And just to give you an example, my own alma mater issued something that fell into the rubric of being a care package. They touted that they had a whole care package in place to help students succeed. So I read this care package, and nowhere in there was psychological support. Now, that is astounding to me, since they have a very famous school of social work. And you would think that with a department of psychology and a sophisticated group of people leading the institution, that they would have added mental wellness to their list of things they're focusing on, but they didn't. And the tragedy of it is that when I pointed it out, the people in the student services end of it got it, but they never changed the plan. And so to have a careness plan or a wellness plan that does not encompass the psychological well-being of students is totally missing the mark. And if you look at the literature on student mental health, you don't have to look much farther than that. So it is not only the changing demographic and our response to the changing demographic, but it's the struggles the students themselves are experiencing when they're encountering institutions that aren't responsive to them. So, you know, we can say students should pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and that's how we did it for centuries. And, you know, just like, by the way, you can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's physically impossible. The whole phrase has no meaning. And in fact, ironically, it used to historically mean the opposite. It went to show you what you couldn't do, not what you should do. But anyway, the idea that students should just sink or swim, our job is to teach content, our job is not to coddle or snowflake or whatever, I'm sorry, that's just not accurate. That's not being an educator in the fullest sense of the word. Now, maybe it passed for being an educator 20 years ago or 30 years ago, or even for some people today. But the task of an educator, including in college, is to do vastly more than teach content. Education happens in many places and spaces, of which the classroom is but one.
If you're experiencing any level of marketing challenge right now, you've got to ask the hard questions and you need answers. Are you using the right mix of channels to get in front of your future students? Is your messaging personalized and delivered in a medium your audience and future students will respond to? And are you spending more time building reporting then listening in on what your students really want. All of these questions will get answered when you sign up for your free consultation with MDT Marketing. Head to mdtmarketing.com/edup, submit your information, and talk to MDT. Don't go it alone. Find the right partner. The guys at MDT, the team at MDT is absolutely amazing. Whether your challenge is the cost of inquiries, your melt, your branding, the bad and incomplete information that come with your inquiries, whatever it is, an audit of your challenges will help your institution, and it's free. mdtmarketing.com/edup.
I think one of the problems we face just as a country in general is we're always reactive and not proactive. And I think we see that across the board, and particularly when it comes to medicine or dealing with issues like this, and then the stigmatizing of mental health on top of that. Now, the generation coming up, like, you know, my kids are in college right now, and they're a lot more open than we were about that. But one of the things that really kind of came to mind is the re-traumatizing of the students is kind of what I heard, was that, yes, they've gone through this trauma, and now they're coming to the school, to the institution, or dealing with their teachers who don't understand this trauma, or are putting up barriers or whatever it might be, or putting these half-hearted efforts into it, like with the care package. And then now all of a sudden you just kind of, you know, threw salt into the wound.
Yes. You know, in a way, if you remember the hearings surrounding Justice Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey Ford, she, for many women, awakened an awareness of traumas they had had years before, that they'd somehow managed to cabin psychologically and they hadn't come out. And interestingly, when she was repeatedly asked, well, how did you get home? How did you get from point A to point B? What did the room look like? And she said, I can't remember. And she, by the way, is an expert on memory and tried to explain it. But one of the things that trauma does is it irreparably alters your memory. I mean, it literally kills off neural pathways. So it's not that she wasn't traumatized. If anything, her absence of memory of how she got home is proof that she was traumatized. And so the reason I raise that is she has two front doors. Now, there's a very savvy professor with a PhD who has two front doors. Why? Because she always wants to make sure she can get out. Trauma stays with you. It's like an invisible backpack. And when you're little, one hopes that the backpack is relatively small. Then as you move forward in time, that backpack keeps growing and growing and growing. And heavier and heavier and heavier. And some people's backpack is bigger than others. But we all have now a backpack filled with trauma. And if nobody sees it, then that not seeing it does what you just described. It makes the situation even worse.
And so I think in that context, then, thinking in particular from the, you know, social, economic, and racial disparities that exist, that the lack of seeing, for example, what we're looking at right now with George Floyd, for example, and people are debating whether or not, you know, was it the drugs that killed him and not the police officer, right? And so there's this whole other set of lens that people are seeing the world in that's not necessarily the same as their students or anyone else. And that's, and then now it's not validated. And they're living that trauma through this trial again and again and again. That's now going to be debated in schools and whatever else. And so this lack of empathy and the lack of recognizing that, you know, there are other narratives that exist in the world. How does a school, you know, and educators address their own bias and not exacerbating those traumas?
Okay, so you're raising a really good question, and I want to use it in two ways. One, to discuss a solution, but one, to think about it a little more. So it's important, if you're white and female, to self-situate before you talk about trauma. It's like men who want to talk about childbirth. It's a little hard to do. You may have watched it, but a little hard to do if you've never actually given birth. So you got to self-situate. I self-situate with my trauma all the time. And I do it very publicly. I do it in my books. I do it in my writing. Because while the color of my skin is white, what's really important is the trauma that I experienced inside. And the fact that I grew up speaking a language in addition to English, and all sorts of other pieces that account for why I actually may understand this in ways that people might not assume on the outside. Now, the George Floyd situation, you assume people are talking about it in school. And I'd ask you, how are they talking about it? In what way is this issue being raised in school? So I think there's a strategy involving what I call pop-up courses. So pop-up courses are courses that when there's a sudden thing that happens in the world, you create a voluntary small course led by a faculty member or teacher to discuss not the issue exactly, because you want to avoid some politics probably and some other issues, but allows students to develop a vocabulary and a way of processing really complicated issues. So here's one from the George Floyd hearings thus far. Why is it that certain people turned off or deleted the videos they made of what happened? That's your pop-up course. When do you decide to video and keep it? And when do you decide to use your cell phone video? And then, for reasons that were obvious to some of us, but perhaps not to others, why were they deleted? So these are all teachable moments if we use them, but we often don't give students the vocabulary or the reading or the architecture for thinking about these issues. So I would take a piece of the George Floyd thing, I'd offer a pop-up course or two, and I'd let students who want to engage in it thoughtfully. They maybe read an op-ed or two, maybe they listen to a segment of the trial or two, and then use it as an opportunity for learning. And these come up, by the way, all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, whether it's disparities in vaccination distribution, or whether it's health disparities in terms of access to quality healthcare, quality education.
As an educator, though, I mean, there's the need to push through your own discomfort for the sake of your students. But we're talking about self-care in respects of students and so forth. But what happens to the teacher that has to live through that trauma themselves? And now is being asked to address an issue that they've had to live themselves in some form or fashion.
Okay, so you're raising a whole other topic, right? Which is, how do we take care of our educators? And let's just start with this expression: you can't pour from an empty cup. So if our educators are drained and struggling, they're not going to teach particularly well. So if whatever is happening, whether it's from the pandemic or other things, are traumatizing them, then their capacity to educate well is diminished. And so it's in our best interest to help our educators fill their cup so that they are not disabled from doing their very best to educate our students. Now, there are lots of strategies for doing that. But one thing that I think every school should have right now when it reopens is what I call care rooms, which are rooms where teachers, separately from students, can go when things get too much and they need a place to process. And there can be play tables in there with all sorts of manipulables, and weighted blankets and scents and music and a trained person to help people have conversations, but we need to acknowledge the need to process. And I do a lot of work with teachers. They're exhausted. They're exhausted on every level. They're exhausted physically, they're exhausted psychologically, they have their own family trauma thing going, and then they're experiencing secondary trauma because of their students. And we need to help them. One of the things I did with three other educators is we set up a virtual teacher's lounge, a pilot virtual teacher's lounge, and we meet every other week for 2 hours. And yes, it's an opportunity to vent, but it's also an opportunity to process and to learn and to share. And the educators, all of whom are now teaching, are saying, I look forward to the virtual teacher's lounge because I'm getting a kind of engagement that's fortifying me to do my job better. So
I'm so glad you brought that up, Karen, because I think that sometimes, and I'm so glad that Loki drilled down on that, the idea that with faculty, a lot of times the focus is so much on what we need to do for the students, and a lot of it is subject and content related, not so much on the mental health aspect. And then we definitely don't focus on our own mental health either. We don't think about that we're exhausted. We don't think about, I love these strategies that you brought up, and I would really encourage our listeners, especially leadership and administrators, to think about the pop-up courses and thinking about the care rooms, because I think sometimes we get caught up in the curriculum and it's like, okay, we can't address George Floyd, that's just happening, or we can't address issues with vaccine or healthcare disparity because this is the curriculum, this is what we have to cover. And sometimes faculty, I think, are a little hesitant to break out of that. So I'm so glad that you brought some of these strategies up, because I think that just incorporating these and getting into the idea that we have to be more student-centered is going to be so essential as we move forward. Our administrators, and I want to be cognizant of your time, so I want to wrap up in a few minutes, but are administrators talking to you more about being student-centered? Are they focusing on some of these strategies as far as looking at how to be more mindful about faculty, especially now with the pandemic and everyone having to just jump and look at all these different methodologies and online and how to accommodate students? Are administrators aware of that?
So I would tell you that one of the observations I've been making of late is that I should have done more training of administrators. Most of my focus has been on training faculty and educators and people in organizations as opposed to leaders. And unfortunately, I think lots of leaders have missed. And that's not to say now is an easy time to lead. And it's not like there isn't a lot on the platter. But I think, sadly, they haven't become trauma responsive leaders. And let me give you an example, because it has worked when I've given the suggestion to those outside of education. Now, I want to admit, education is slow to change, right? I mean, there's lots of industries that are vastly more flexible and nimble than education, which is ironic, right? I mean, in a very sad way, you would think education should be the most nimble and flexible of all the areas, but educators get entrenched. They get, you know, stuck on their notebooks or their computers or the course notes that they've used for the last however many's they've been doing it. So I had the leader of a large organization with 10,000 employees come to me at the beginning and say, okay, what do I do? How do I create community amongst my workers? Now, this is not the end users of their product, by the way. So this is the equivalent of a leader saying, how do I help my faculty and staff? And I said, you send them a message every single day. And it could be a short email message or a long email message. It should involve at some point some humor, substance, everything. It's got to be honest. It's got to be transparent. It has to be worded in ways that are thoughtful in terms of what people are experiencing. And you ought to explain to them why you're doing it. So I would say for the first month, he sent them to me before he sent them out. And I'd say, okay, this one's fine. Oh, no, not this one. This one's way too long. Like, oh my goodness. And then he got on a roll and he started doing it. And it has been spectacular. They're so good. I told him you should put them in a book and make a book. And, and he's created community. I mean, he shared everything from where his home office is and his dog to travels with his partner to wherever park they would go, to stories about board meetings, to comments about public events in the world in terms of healthcare disparities, because they work in the healthcare field, to personal stories about how he zoomed out and then he'd show a picture of himself with his head like falling over the computer. And it was spectacular. I mean, really, he did an amazing job. And, you know, one day there was a group that still worked in the office. I don't remember what they did, but some technical thing that they had to be there. And he did a special focus on them and he had pictures of them and all those things. And his effort to create community has endured. And he's better for it. Educators would do well. Now ask the question, how many principals, heads of schools, and college presidents have sent a daily email to every member of their community?
I can answer that question just based on my own experience. But yeah, I mean, it's funny when you started to tell the story, my face lit up because I can imagine how transformative that would be, but it's not something that we see a lot of. So I got to thank you for sharing a lot of this insight. I want to be cognizant of your time and really be appreciative of all this insight that you shared with us today. Loki asked you some amazing questions. I'm like, I might need to bring him to my next faculty meeting. He might need to be asking some questions in there. So thank you so much, Karen. You've given us a lot to think about, a lot of gems here that we definitely know that our listeners will be able to benefit from, especially those administrators and those that really want to make a difference. So we thank you for your time. We want to wrap up by just asking you the last couple of questions, which is there anything that we've missed? Anything that you want to share with us about anything that you're doing, upcoming books or initiatives or trainings? And then other than that, what do you see as the future for higher education?
Well, you would need me for another hour to do all that. But the first thing is most of what I'm doing and many of my books and downloadable PDFs are on my website, which is www.karengross.com. Said like grows, you know, like you grow, but spelt like Gross, education.com. So KarenGrossEducation.com. I am doing two programs that are coming up. One maybe too soon for your listeners because I don't know exactly when you post this. But on June 19th, I'm doing a program with three other educators on how to reopen schools successfully. It's on June 19th. It's from 12 to 2. It's sponsored by Delta Kappa Gamma, which is the Women Educators Honor Society. It's not a sorority. Delta Kappa Gamma is a long-standing international women educators group. And they're doing it, and that will be posted on my website. It'll also be on the DKG Delta Kappa Gamma International Facebook page. That might be a program, and I think they're asking for $3 donations. That's it. I mean, so you can go for free or more or less free and think about how to improve how you launch school in the fall. So that would be my recommendation for that. The other thing I would tell people is I have a piece coming out from Rutgers Graduate School of Education, their Proctor Institute. And it's a piece on why we should have hope. And it's about things we can do in education, even if some we're not doing now, but that we could do that give me hope for the future. So that will be out later this spring, and that may be of interest to your audience as well.
And do you want to take a shot at what you see as the future for higher education? Play futurist for a minute.
Well, I've been asked a lot to predict. And I said I gave up predictions, kind of like, you know, what you give up for Lent, because the facts are changing too much. I can conjecture, but I'm really not predicting. So I would conjecture that we will think about continuing to use some aspects of online learning, but and benefit from the learning that we've had with online learning and integrate it into in-person learning. So I do think that will happen. I think we'll see that maybe some institutions are recognizing that connections, connectivity, and engagement are way more important than they thought they were. So one thing that trauma does is it truncates connectivity. Our brains are wired for connection, and trauma truncates it. And the literature shows that the most positive experience you can give a student is a connection to one or two caring adults who are not their family members. So I do think that we may find that more educators are recognizing the role they can play in the lives of their students. And here's why. Unlike most situations, educators have experienced what students have experienced during this pandemic. And in that sense, there's a literature out of Katrina and the relationship between therapists and patients in the post-Katrina era, in which those therapists talked about that the traditional dividing line between therapist and client, therapist and patient changed because they both had lost their homes. They both had experienced disruption. It wasn't like one was reporting to the other about something the other hadn't experienced. I think if we recognize that we will help students and educators find a different common ground. Now, I'm not suggesting crossing boundaries at all. I am suggesting that there's experiential similarity, which can be parlayed into a strength and used for the collective benefit of both educators and students alike. And I'll leave you with one strategy for how to do that. Every educator in the first week of being back should do an exercise with students of any age, college age, graduate school, high school, elementary school. They should do this exercise. It's the ask me anything moment. You can ask me anything. And as long as the question is within the realm of decency, I'll answer. And I mean, you can literally ask me anything. What it shows is transparency, openness, a willingness to share, an ability to create connections. So we could end here with you can each ask me a question. I mean, not like the ones you've asked before, but you can ask me anything that might be relevant or useful or interesting to you or funny or thoughtful. But if students have educators who ask that question and then engage with them by being open, they will improve the educational experience. And I would conjecture if you do that, you'll improve learning and psychosocial development.
Hey everybody, we hope you enjoyed that episode of The EdUp Experience. To learn more about The EdUp Experience, please visit our website at www.edupexperience.com and subscribe to our email list. Please share this podcast, head over to Apple, and please give us a rating and review. We appreciate your feedback. And of course, subscribe to The EdUp Experience so you're notified when our episodes drop. Here at The EdUp Experience, our goal is to make education your business. Thanks for listening.